Okay, everyone, so welcome once again. I have just come back from a long trip overseas. I've been away for almost 8 weeks altogether, the last 6 weeks overseas. It's always interesting when you travel because it gives you a bit of a different perspective on things, seeing the world from a different point of view. Every society looks at Buddhism slightly differently, depending on the conditions in that society. And it's always kind of nice to come back again here afterwards, after all that traveling is always very good, to a very strong Buddhist community that we have right here in Perth. And one of the things that I notice when you travel around the world is how much interest there is in these Buddhist teachings. There's a lot of people who are interested in the spiritual practice and how to kind of do something with our minds, develop our minds in a certain direction. I think people recognize that at the end of the day, it is the mind that really matters. And if we can develop the mind, then that is really the source of all happiness and reduction of suffering and problems in our lives. And people recognize this around the world. And so there is a lot of interest in the Buddhist practice. And one of the countries where there was the most interest, where I was recently, was in Poland. You may not think that there would be so much interest in Poland, but actually that was one of the places where there was lots of interest. And I think the reason is because Poland is a Catholic country. Catholic countries, they already have a very strong spiritual tradition with monasticism and the idea of meditation and prayer, which often can be a bit like meditation as well, is already very strongly part of that society. And then when Buddhism comes along, they're kind of this ready to kind of look at alternative traditions, especially when they turn away from Catholicism because of all the scandals and problems. And so that's why kind of the ground has been prepared when we kind of come overseas and we go to these countries. So I think there's lots of opportunity, lots of interest out there. And so one of the things that I want to talk about today is, apart from the idea, of course, that Buddhism is a very beautiful spiritual path with meditation, with all the kind of factors that go into the spiritual practice. One of the amazing things about the discourses of the Buddha, the suttas, is how detailed they are about the spiritual practice. And if you want to hear more about those details, come on a retreat. On the retreats, that's where we talk about those details in a lot of detail. Details in detail. And it's amazing how rich these Buddhist discourses are in terms of spiritual practice, how they go into how they have this kind of large bird, they have this bird's eye view, and then they hone in on the little details that are necessary for this practice to work. In a sense, you can say that all the Buddhist scriptures are really about practice. There's 10,000 pages in the Pali language all about how to purify your mind, how to live a good life, and how to come out the other end as a better person as a consequence. So this is already fairly well known around the world, that Buddhism is about these things. But there's far more in Buddhism that makes Buddhism a very special kind of teaching. I would say unique in the world. There are aspects of Buddhism you don't find anywhere else in any other teaching, any other philosophy, anything else. And I want to talk a little bit today about those things that make Buddhism unique. The things that to me have always been very attractive about the Buddhist teachings. In fact, when I think about these Buddhist teachings, and how, to me, how extraordinary and marvelous they really are. Even though there's a lot of interest when I go overseas, actually, at the end of the day, I wonder, why isn't there even more interest? Why is there only 200 people coming to the talk? Maybe there should be 2,000, or 20,000, or 200,000. How many people are there in Perth again? 1.5 million. Why aren't there 1.5 million people coming here to Dhammaloka on Friday night? Everyone should be here. Why isn't everyone a Buddhist? That's what I wonder. Isn't that right? Yeah, you know, you have got it right, exactly. Why isn't everyone a Buddhist? That's what I wonder, because to me, these teachings are so powerful. They have to do with the very kind of essence about what life is all about happiness, overcoming problems, about the meaning of life itself. To my mind, everyone should be a Buddhist. this kind of dream on. But I mean, that's kind of the that's kind of where it's really at. And so I want to focus on some of those things. First of all, to see what attracts people to Buddhism, and also to point out those areas that are really attractive, and to see if more people then actually may join us on this amazing spiritual path, which promises so much and also delivers on those promises. So one of the places I like to start is to start with understanding that Buddhism is like a universal religion. It is a religion that actually from the very beginning had a very universal outlook. It was not a religion that was for a particular people at a particular place, but from the very start it had this kind of universal idea. This is for everyone. This is actually not limited to a particular time and place. And what you find is that the vast majority of religions around the world, they are very parochial. They belong to a time and place. They are often a covenant between a people and their God. Yeah, a large number of religions are exactly this. They are a covenant between a particular people and their God. And they're very small, small religions. They are my tribe with my God, and then the other tribe is over here, and they have their God. And then the people fight, and sometimes the gods fight up in heaven, just to kind of mirror what the people do on the ground. It's funny how these things tend to mirror each other in these, way, these ways. And so most religions are kind of small. And you can see that when you start to read the scriptures of some of these religions, they relate to that particular people. They relate to the problems of that culture. They talk about issues that relate to that kind of area of the world, wherever the religion is coming from. But Buddhism is different. Buddhism, I think, is maybe the only religion, the only philosophy, the only whatever in the world, which actually from the very beginning had a universal outlook. From the very start, it was not really about, when the Buddha was around 2,500 years ago in India, it wasn't really about India. It wasn't about the Buddha talking to the Indians around him and trying to make those Indians happy. From the very start, the Buddha had a universal outlook at what he's teaching. And to me, this is, of course, extraordinarily interesting, because this changes the whole dynamic about what religion is about. Religion is not about then seeking protection from a particular god, and having your little society looked after by your god, but actually it is about this large outlook, and this larger outlook then concerns the very profound and important aspects of what life really is about, the meaning of life itself, if you like. And we know that this is the case, that this is the way the Buddha was thinking. We know that because in the suttas, in the way he spoke, the Buddha always says that he sets in motion the wheel of the Dhamma. It's called the Dhamma Chakka Pavattana in the Pali language. It means setting in motion the wheel of the Dhamma. He knew that when he gave the first discourse, and the first discourse of the Buddha was given in a place called Saranath in India, close to Varanasi, he knew that when he gave that first discourse, that he was setting in motion the wheel of the Dhamma. And the idea of setting in motion the wheel of the Dhamma is the idea that the Dhamma has a certain momentum. When you start that wheel, when you roll that wheel into the world, you know that it will not stop until the momentum comes to an end. And when the wheel rolls into the world, it rolls from one culture to another, it rolls from one century to another century, and it kind of, after a while, it encompasses all of humanity, as we actually see now when Buddhism exists pretty much all over the world. So the Buddha knew what he was doing from the very beginning, was starting this enormous movement that would spread out into the world. And because he knew that, he would phrase his teaching in a very particular way. When you start reading the suttas of the Buddha, you get this feeling that actually these suttas are not really given to the people of that particular culture. They have a universal feel about them. They talk about the aspects of the human mind. They talk about human psychology. And of course, human psychology hasn't changed very much at all in 2,500 years. Yeah, people are still angry and greedy and jealous. Exactly the same 2,500 years later. Nothing has really changed Yeah, we're still same defilement, same problems, same issues, problems with my wife, problems with my husband, problems with my kids, problems with our fellows in the Buddhist society, wars, nothing has changed. It's all exactly the same. Well, you know, exactly, kind of slight change of, you know, of a kind of the background a little bit, but basically the same things are happening. So the Buddha was talking to these universal problems and the universal realities of human existence. And because of that, when you enter the suttas and you start to read the word of the Buddha, you recognize what is going on. It's as if the Buddha is talking to you. Why? Because, precisely because these are not limited to a particular culture and a particular place. And so when the Buddha gave these teachings 2,500 years ago, he knew that there would be people in the future listening to these teachings. He knew that there were people in Australia. Actually, I don't think know if Australia really did. Australia exist? It existed as a land, but it wasn't called Australia in those days. So he knew that there were people in everywhere around the world, maybe with the exception of Antarctica. Maybe there probably are Buddhists in Antarctica as well these days. I'm sure there must be some Buddhists down there, everywhere basically. And so he taught those teachings with that in mind and gave those teachings, took away the cultural baggage, took away those things that are specific to that Indian culture and gave it a universal appeal, because Buddhism is one of the few teachings that was universal from the very, very start. And this, to me, is very powerful and beautiful. It is not something that developed from something small, but it's something that had this kind of broad outlook from the very beginning. Someone who knew what he was talking about from the very start, delivering a crucial message to humanity. So this universal idea is actually, to me, something that is very, very appealing about Buddhism. And again, it makes it very different from almost any other religion or philosophy. And one of the aspects of this universality of Buddhism, and another thing which I always found very interesting here, is that in Buddhism we don't really have a savior in the way that they have in some other religions. It's quite common for religions to have like a prophet or a savior or someone who comes along and kind of delivers the message to people, and then you find, you know, the truth through that person or whatever. But in Buddhism it isn't really like that. Yes, there is a Buddha. But the Buddha is just really a person who arises in the world at a certain interval of time. Yeah, there has been Buddhas in the past, there were more Buddhas in the future. A Buddha is not a unique person in the history of the world, but it's just one instance of a person discovering the truth and then delivering that truth to humanity and giving us all access to that truth. But there have been other Buddhas in the past. Going back, if you go back into the past, there's probably no beginning to the number of Buddhas in the past. And as the world carries on into the future, there will be more Buddhas in the future. We don't know when those Buddhas will arise. Don't think that you're going to wait for the next Buddha and then you're going to become enlightened. Yeah, because when the next Buddha comes around, you will not recognize that Buddha anyway. You'll think, yeah, whatever, and you kind of walk a different direction and you get it all wrong. So don't wait for the next Buddha. Now is the time to do the practice. My point is just to say that there isn't like one person who has arisen to save humanity. But there is this sequence of Buddhas. And again, this is another beautiful aspect. And it universalizes the idea. Yeah, every now and again, conditions come together in such a way that a person is able to discover this profound truth. There have been these Buddhas in the past. There is a Buddha in fairly recent history, only 2,500 years ago. That's just like yesterday in the kind of big cosmological view of Buddhism, right? 2,500 years ago is nothing in this kind of, so it's very recent, and then again in the future. So there isn't one savior. There's just every now and again someone actually carries, understands reality, and then brings the message to the world. And again, this is universal idea of things. Our times are not special. I don't know about you, but I always feel a bit uncomfortable if our time is so special. Yeah, the Savior arose in our time, and if you weren't born in our time, then, well, you have a problem. To me, that sounds always a little bit, I don't know, I can't really find it hard to buy into that. I need something that is more kind of universal in its outlook. So this is the first, to me, kind of important pillar upon which a lot of the good things in Buddhism kind of arise. Another important part for me of the Buddhist teaching, which makes it very special and perhaps unique again among philosophies and religions of the world, is that Buddhism is essentially naturalistic. Yeah, when I say naturalistic, I mean naturalistic in contrast to supernatural. Supernatural are things that are outside of nature. Naturalistic are things that are within nature. Buddhism has a naturalistic outlook in the sense that everything is part of nature. Nothing is really outside of it. And you may think, perhaps, that there are supernatural things in Buddhism. I don't know how you think about that, but maybe you think that there are things like rebirth. Well, isn't rebirth supernatural? How does that possibly happen? Or maybe you think that there are other things that you have heard about in Buddhism that seem a bit supernatural to you. But actually, that is not really the case. Because rebirth, even though it is kind of not part of our ordinary worldview, it is not really supernatural. It is still part of the mechanism of how the world operates. Either the world operates through mechanisms like rebirth, or it doesn't. Buddhism says it does, but it's not really supernatural. It is just a broader view of thinking about nature. And our view of nature is always expanding, right? We peer into the universe, we peer into the subatomic particles, and we see more detail, we expand our view of reality, we understand the laws of physics perhaps better, we understand more about the laws of biology and chemistry, and our outlook of the world is always expanding. And I say rebirth is just one of those further expansions of the outlook of the world, but it's still part of the natural order of things. It is not supernatural. So Buddhism, everything is natural. And this contrasts again very much with religions, especially religions where there is a creator god. Creator gods are very common in humanity around the world. And when you have a creator god, by definition, that creator god stands outside of nature. Because that thing which creates nature must by definition be beyond nature, otherwise it wouldn't be able to create nature. And so that is why many of these ideas would be called supernatural, because they're not part of the natural order. And this is where, again, Buddhism distinguishes itself from actually being, I say, a naturalistic religion. And that's kind of fascinating, yeah? So when we are on the Buddhist path, there's nothing really supernatural that we need to do. We don't need to believe in things that are kind of weird. All of the Buddhist path is actually about insight into that very nature that we haven't actually seen properly before. Buddhism, when you do your meditation practice or whatever, you start to feel peaceful, you start to feel calm because you're enjoying meditation. What you're doing is you're allowing nature to take its course through you. That peace, that feeling that you feel inside, is just a natural feeling that arises through the meditation practice. And as you take that down the line, and as you start to gain insights and wisdoms and understanding of what Buddhism is about, again, it is just a deeper appreciation of the nature of the world. That is what we are uncovering here. Nothing really beyond that. That is what this whole path is about. Yeah, so it is a naturalistic religion. And again, this to me is very kind of confidence-inspiring. Because if you are dealing with nature, dealing with things, then we are really grounded. We're not taking off, not kind of prone to losing ourselves in some kind of fantasy realm, anything like that. But we're grounded based on something real, based on something that actually is a part of the nature around us. So naturalistic. And one very important aspect of this naturalism, actually there's a couple of things maybe I could talk about here. One of the things that are really interesting to me is the beginning of the universe. Right? If you talk about the beginning of the universe, it's almost every religion seems to think it is its job to talk about the beginning of the universe. All religions do that. But what does Buddhism say? Is there a beginning of the universe? The Buddha says, no beginning of the universe is to be discovered. Yeah, again, this makes kind of Buddhism unique among all, not only among religions, but even science itself. Science says that the universe, well, this is kind of the predominant theory anyway in science, that the universe began with the Big Bang. There are other theories that there were previous universes. That seems to be the predominant thing these days. But Buddhism says that there is no beginning. There is no first point. And to me, that is a really, really satisfying explanation. Because we see evolution all the time. We see things changing all the time. We see one thing leading to something else, cause leading to effect, and the new effect becoming the cause for something else. Things always moving on. And it doesn't really make much sense to talk about the first point. If some being created the universe, well, why does that being exist? It doesn't really explain anything when you say that some being created the universe. When you say that the Big Bang started just like that, that also doesn't really explain anything, because it doesn't say why that energy, why that Big Bang came into existence in the first place. So Buddhism, to me, is really the only teaching that I found that has a plausible answer to this question. Yeah, it is always goes back to something earlier. There is no first point in existence. There was a universe before the previous, or the existing one, and one before that, going back into the inconceivable past. No first point can be discovered. You will notice the Buddha doesn't say it goes back to infinity, because that would be impossible to know. He just says no first point can be discovered. It's a very kind of scientific kind of outlook that the Buddha has, very pragmatic. He tells you what he has seen, but doesn't go beyond the facts of the matter. And so this, again, to me, is one of those beautiful ideas where Buddhism has got it right. And I remember I gave a talk here a few years ago, and I was saying to everyone that I'm going to lay down a bet here and now. I don't have any money, so I can't bet very much. I can bet maybe, I'm not sure what I can bet. I can bet... What can I bet? Not much. I can bet my meal for one day, right? So if you like, if you're very hungry, come to the monastery, and I bet that down the track, the world, the scientific world, is going to come down on the Buddhist idea of how the cosmos operates. Yeah, the cosmos goes in cycles. Yeah, there's like a Big Bang and maybe something called like the Big Crunch or whatever it is. It's like a cyclical thing, however you want to do it. And at some point down the track, my bet is cosmology is going to come to the Buddhist point of view. What do you think about that? Do you think that's nuts? Do you think I'm kind of fundamentalist Buddhist lunatic? Yeah. Maybe I am. Because how can I say the Buddha got it right and the science maybe not? Isn't that kind of the very sign of fundamentalism? But this is kind of weird, right? Because I say, well, first of all, I think that there is no consensus in science on the beginning of the universe anyway. And when there is no consensus, well, you can pick your choices, what you prefer. But to me, the word of the Buddha is so powerful and so interesting that I'm willing to elevate the word of the Buddha to a very, very high place. And if I think the Buddha said something, I think it is going to be true. Maybe the Buddha didn't say some of these things. And if the Buddha didn't say it, of course, then it can be relegated to some lesser, and maybe it may not be true. But if the Buddha did say something, then to me, it is very, very, very likely to be true. Yeah, sometimes we have to give a little bit of leeway for similes and metaphors and speaking in pictures and these kind of things, but generally speaking, we're going to be on the right track if we follow the Buddha. I want to give an example of this while I'm at it, and that is the example of the idea of rebirth. Are there many people here who are skeptical of the idea of rebirth? Everyone here is a one over there? Okay, one skeptic over there. Okay, good. So that's good. At least we have one skeptic in the order. And I'm sure there are more, but that's a bit embarrassing to raise your hands. That's all right. You don't have to raise your hand. But let me take the idea of rebirth. There's a lot of people in the world who actually believe in rebirth. Yeah, even among atheists and agnostics and everyone, lots of people believe in this. Christians, Muslims, Buddhists, of course, Hindus. Lots of people believe in rebirth across the board. But also, a lot of people are skeptical about rebirth. Yeah? And that is, of course, okay, because it is hard to know. And but what exactly is the evidence for rebirth? And you can say many things are the evidence for rebirth: people remembering past lives, children remembering past lives, near-death experiences. There's actually a lot of things that may point in that direction. But I say there is one thing that is more important evidence than any other evidence. And now the fundamentalist Buddhist in me comes out again. And that is because the Buddha said that there is rebirth. If the Buddha said there is rebirth, for me, there is rebirth. No more questions need to be asked. That's the end of the story here. How can I say that? And the reason I say that, one of the reasons why people think it is hard to believe the Buddha is because he lived 2,500 years ago. Yeah, he lived in this foreign culture called India 2,500 years ago. It's a long time ago. We have no idea who the Buddha was. How can we possibly take that seriously? That is a kind of mentality we have, and I had that mentality myself. I know exactly what it is. The Buddha is like forgotten in the mist of history. We have no idea about the Buddha. We cannot really take that as seriously as we do modern ideas. But actually, that would be wrong. Yeah. Why is it wrong? Well, the reason why it is wrong in exactly the same way as when you go to school and you go to a history class and the teacher tells you there was a battle at Waterloo in 1814 and Napoleon lost the battle of Waterloo. Right? Did you learn that in school? Yeah, okay, I learned that in school anyway. I don't know what they learn these days, but when I went to school a long time ago, I learned that in school. And did I believe the teacher? Of course I believe the teacher. Don't really have any grounds to disbelieve the teacher. There was no one with kind of posters outside saying Waterloo is fake news or anything like that, right? There was nothing like that, so I believed it. Yeah, in those days, that was before the time of fake news. And we believe it for good reasons. Why would the teacher not tell us the truth? Why would the teacher lie to us? Why would the history books be completely wrong? Of course, history books are not going to be exactly right. There's going to be problems in the history books. But I think certain basic facts are probably right in the history books. That Napoleon lost the battle of Waterloo is probably quite likely to have to be the case. And we believe these things. Why? Because there's no reason not to. And of course, when it comes to teachers, the Buddha is a far more interesting and impressive teacher than your high school teacher. Your high school teacher may have been a good person, yeah, may have been a very nice person, but the Buddha is somehow very much more impressive than your high school teacher. There's something very beautiful about the Buddha. When you read the suttas and you see the word of the Buddha, you really get this feeling of someone extraordinary, some kind of spiritual genius. The greatest person in recorded history is how I will look at the Buddha. And because of that, if you are going to believe your history teacher in high school, you should believe the Buddha 1,000, 1,000,000, 1,000,000,000 times more, because this is a very exceptional person. And the only reason we don't find it hard to do that is because the Buddha lived so long ago in such a different culture. But actually, that's irrelevant. It doesn't matter whether he lived 2,500 years ago. As long as we know that a person like the Buddha did exist, as long as we have reasonable grounds to think that he taught those things, and we have very, very good grounds to think that he taught rebirth. Why? Because it's everywhere in the Buddhist texts. So then it becomes like your history teacher, except 1,000,000-fold more stronger. So should you then believe the Buddha when he teaches rebirth, or should you reject it as superstition? I tell you, you should believe it because the Buddha said it. Much more than you should believe the Battle of Waterloo in 1814. That is my kind of approach to these things. And think about it and see if it makes any sense. It's really just a matter of kind of looking at things in a slightly new way. But my point here is really about the idea that Buddhism is naturalistic. It talks about the nature of things, yeah? It talks about how sometimes, kind of by and by, about how the universe evolved. That is, of course, not very central to the Buddhist teachings. But also, the other thing which is very naturalistic in Buddhism is that the person or the being that we kind of look up to in Buddhism, that we respect to Buddhism, is another human being. The Buddha is a human being, for goodness sake. And that is kind of really inspiring. Instead of having a God that is really unattainable, that is beyond kind of anything you can really grasp or understand, something which is kind of really foreign to us, that lives in a secluded realm all of its own, in Buddhism, it is another human being that we respect. And there's something very beautiful and powerful about that, because it means we can relate to the Buddha in a very direct way. We can never really relate to a creator God in a direct way, because a creator God is beyond us. All we have to do is kind of pray and ask, oh, please help us, or whatever. But you can't really relate to a creator, because it's a completely different kind of entity from what we are. I don't even know if you can call it an entity. I don't know what you can call it. But in Buddhism, we are dealing with another human being. And that means that there is a direct means of communication between that Buddha and us. And that is very powerful. And this makes reading the suttas, reading the word of the Buddha, even more interesting. Here the Buddha tells you, he says, before my awakening, well, I was an ordinary person, just like you. No, he doesn't say just like you. I'm just adding that just for interest. He just says, well, I was just an ordinary person, still unawakened. Yeah. He says, I too had defilements in the mind. I got angry sometimes. I had desires. I was deluded. The Buddha says, before my awakening, I also was attached to things that lead to more problems. The things in the world that lead to old age, death and suffering, I too was attached to those things, said the Buddha before his awakening. I had wrong view before my awakening. The Buddha's wrong view was that he thought that pain would lead to happiness. Just like most people in the world believe, yeah, no pain, no gain. No pain, no gain is the definition of pain leading to happiness. It is our society is kind of completely saturated with this idea. No pain, no gain is wrong from a Buddhist point of view. Happiness leads to gain. Pain does not necessarily lead to gain. Very important point. That was the Buddha's wrong view. And the more you read about the Buddha's autobiographical suttas, talking about his own experience before his awakening, you get this feeling that he is one of us. He's just like us in many ways. Maybe he did have some very powerful spiritual qualities, obviously, otherwise he wouldn't become the Buddha. But essentially, he's a human being just like us. And then he takes that human nature. He purifies himself. He stops. He lives in a very moral, compassionate, and kind way. He purifies his mind from defilements. And he achieves something he calls awakening, sambodhi, on this path. And he shows that he is able to transform his humanity into something that goes beyond being an ordinary person, showing that we can do exactly the same thing. There's something very powerful about having another human being as your teacher. When we bow down to the Buddha, what we're bowing down to? We're bowing down to a human being perfected. Someone has taken the human condition and lifted it up to the highest potential. That is what you're bowing down to. You're bowing down to those qualities that the Buddha has developed, the wisdom, the compassion. And those qualities are within each one of us. The seeds are there. And all we have to do is to develop them in the same way the Buddha did. And the consequences will be that we too reach the same state, the same qualities that the Buddha himself attained on his awakening night. In a sense, we become pretty much just like the Buddha. So this, is the idea. This is a naturalistic thing. We're dealing with humanity. We're dealing with things that are close to us. We're not dealing with things that are far away. And this, to me, again, makes the Buddhist teaching so exceptional and so extraordinary. So the Buddha comes along, gives us all these teachings, tells us that he has attained these things, and then he teaches us in the same way and says, these are the things that you should do. And when you read the suttas, you get this feeling that you are in the presence of that Buddha teaching you in this way. And one of the amazing things about the suttas, about this holy scriptures of Buddhism, I'm not talking about the early Buddha suttas, those suttas that we can say with a high degree of confidence came from the Buddha himself. When you read them, they are so simple. They are so easy to read once you get used to the style. they, I cannot take out all the things that are not really required. Yeah, all the kind of trappings of culture and kind of things that are not really directly related to the practice of the spiritual path. And all that is left are these beautiful things, simple, direct, quite easy to understand. And if you compare the Buddhist teachings, the Buddha suttas, to any other scriptures, wherever you may have from the ancient world in this way, there's nothing like it. Everything else is tied to a certain culture, tied to a certain place, talks about the way they live their life, talks about things that is very hard for us to understand. The Buddha scriptures are really quite exceptional, in that they are so straight to the point, so simple, and so kind of easily accessible. And I always like to make the point that if you're going to try to understand Buddhism, it is far easier to understand Buddhism by reading the early suttas than it is by reading contemporary teachers. Contemporary teachers may seem very interesting on the surface, and I'm not saying you shouldn't read them. Please do. But actually, to really understand the details and the full profundity of this teaching, there's nothing like the word of the Buddha. Again, this shows me this simplicity here, this kind of down-to-earthness in the way the Buddha taught. And some of the practices that he taught were also very down-to-earth. He taught things like mindfulness of breathing. Mindfulness of breathing, the kind of meditation we often teach here, is kind of the basic teaching, basic meditation practice for reaching awakening. Very simple, very down-to-earth, very grounding, very unlikely to make you go nuts. Lots of people go nuts in meditation, right? No, I'm exaggerating. Not lots. Sometimes people go nuts, and that's because they are not careful. But certainly mindfulness of breathing helps you to not go nuts. If you don't want to go nuts, do mindfulness of breathing. It's kind of one of the safeguards on this path. And also kind of be careful in general, of course. But there's something beautiful about that. Simplicity. And this is what you find throughout this word of the Buddha. Simple and straight to the point. And no kind of big problems with this. The other thing which is very important with this is that the Buddha says, well, actually, I just point the way. You have to do the practice yourself. It just occurred to me today when I was driving in here that the Buddhist teachings are really like the first self-help manual. Yeah, you go into the self-help shelf in the kind of any bookshelf, it's kind of really big shelf, and a lot of it is kind of slightly dodgy perhaps and not kind of worth reading. The original self-help book are the suttas of the Buddha. Yeah, 10,000 pages of self-help. You go there and it gives you all the way, the self-help, all the way to the highest happiness, overcoming all suffering. Yeah. So the Buddha's teachings are really empowering us. The Buddha doesn't say, believe in me and she'll be right. I'm just showing off my Australian idiom here, just to kind of, you know, show you that I'm the real deal. I'm you know, fair dinkum Aussie. No, the Buddha doesn't say, believe in me and everything will be fine. What the Buddha says, I only point the way. And then you have to practice accordingly. You have to inquire. You have to investigate. You have to actually do this practice. And this is so empowering. In a lot of religions and philosophies around the world, we put our life in the hands of something unknown. We say, oh God, the Creator will look after me after I die or whatever. Maybe, but maybe not. We don't know. We're putting our hands into something we don't know anything about. In Buddhism, instead of doing that, we actually take back, we empower ourselves. We become in charge of our practice. Yes, we are guided by the Buddha. We allow the Buddha to point the way, of course, because there are people who are more advanced than us. But in the end, it's up to us to do this. It is empowering because we form our own minds through our own practice. You do the right thing, you live in a good way, and you see the results that actually come from that. And then you guide yourself in the right direction instead of just holding on to something that you don't really understand, not really aware of. This is kind of really beautiful. And of course, part of that practice, part of this idea of being self-practicing and looking after our own spiritual practice, of being empowered in this way, part of that is the idea of investigating these teachings, trying to understand these teachings. And sometimes when you investigate the teachings of the Buddha, you may perhaps have doubts. Just like someone over here had doubts about rebirth. Yeah, not sure about rebirth yet, and that's perfectly okay. And this is one of those interesting things, again, which I think is quite unique to the Buddha's teachings, that it is okay to have doubt. The Buddha specifically says in the suttas, when there are doubtful things, it is right to have doubt. Yeah, if when there are doubtful things, you kind of just shut it off, you don't want to see it, that's considered bypassing the problem. It is not a good idea. If something is doubtful, it is right to have doubt. Isn't that nice? Instead of doubt being something bad and evil, something that we kind of have to shove into the back of our mind, pretend that it doesn't exist, actually, doubt is perfectly acceptable. It is the right attitude to have when there are doubtful things that actually we encounter on the path. One of those things might be rebirth. If we don't believe in it, we shouldn't force ourselves to believe in rebirth. What we should do, rather, is to try to investigate it. We should say, well, if the Buddha said this, that the Buddha was pretty amazing, the Buddha was pretty cool, to use a modern kind of terminology, cool in the highest sense of the word. If the Buddha said this, maybe I should investigate this. And as you investigate it, you may come to a conclusion one way or the other. And then you will overcome your doubt. That is how you overcome doubt, says the Buddha, by investigating. And then as you investigate, you start to kind of find your way through all of this. As you investigate in this way, and then you start to find your way through this, something else starts to arise in your mind. And what arises in your mind, if you do find the Buddhist teaching to be interesting, confidence starts to arise. Faith in these teachings starts to arise. In Buddhism too, we have the idea of faith. In Buddhism too, we have this idea, maybe better to call it confidence in Buddhism. It's both faith and confidence at the same time. But in Buddhism, again, there is a different angle for understanding the idea of faith and confidence. In many teachings, faith and confidence will maybe have an end in its own right. You are confident about something, or you have faith in something, and that is the end of the day, that is kind of all there is to it. But in Buddhism, it's actually the other way around. Confidence or faith and wisdom go hand in hand. When you become more wise, when you understand the nature of meditation, when you start to have insight into the nature of yourself and your own humanity and your own mind, precisely because you have an understanding, precisely because you have insight into things, your confidence becomes greater. That's exactly how it should be, right? It's like when you go to school, you learn something initially, you're studying mathematics, something initially, you may feel really diffident because you feel, oh, this is beyond me. But as you study it, you start to master the things you're supposed to master. Your confidence grows precisely because you understand. That is exactly the way it is in Buddhism. Confidence and insight, faith and wisdom always go hand in hand, grow together. Again, something that to me seems quite unique to the Buddhist teachings. Something that, again, makes a lot of sense when you think about it. And then as the confidence and the wisdom grow, eventually there comes a point when it becomes very, very powerful. There comes a point when you come to the very crux of what the Buddhist teachings is about. The very core, the very thing that makes the Buddhist teaching absolutely unique compared to anything else in the whole world of human thinking and human endeavor. And what is that? And that is the idea and the insight into the idea of non-self. Non-self is the thing that ultimately is completely unique to the Buddhist teachings, which you don't find anywhere else. All of the other things I've been talking about, you may find to more or less degree in various philosophies, in various religions or whatever. Yet Buddhism has kind of taken it, to my mind, to another stage, another kind of level. But the final thing in this whole thing, the final thing which makes Buddhism absolutely unique, is the idea of non-self. It is not really found in the way that Buddhism teaches it in any other part, any other teaching that you find in the world. And that is the final thing that we need to uncover. And this journey towards non-self, this journey to understand that there is no inherent essence in us as human beings, this is the most exciting and interesting journey you can ever go on. There's a very beautiful simile in the suttas. The suttas are full of similes. The suttas are the words that are packed with similes. And some of these similes are so well made and constructed, as you would expect if they are made by the Buddha. There's a simile in the suttas of a man, or maybe a woman, going through the jungle. And as this person goes through the jungle, they come to this ancient path in the jungle. And when they follow this ancient path in the jungle, going through the trees, going through the understory, they come to this ancient city. You can imagine yourself, yeah, this would be really exciting, right? Going through the forest. Imagine going into the kind of forest here in Perth, the Darling Scarp, finding this ancient track. Doesn't quite work like that in the kind of the bush here in Australia, but anyway, you find some track. And you go into the jungle and you come to this ancient ruins in the jungle. That is really exciting. It's really, really interesting. This is the kind of discovery that everyone kind of, I think, at least for me, is a kind of marvelous thing when you find something extraordinary anywhere. It is always very interesting. And the Buddha says it is exactly the same thing with the spiritual practice. When you go on the spiritual practice, it's like going on this adventure, going on this journey, trying to discover something extraordinary. And the path that you walk is the Noble Eightfold Path. And the ancient city that you discover is Nibbana itself. And Nibbana really is just another term for non-self, the idea of anatta. It's this beautiful journey of discovery. That is what the spiritual path is about. It is an adventure. It is the most exciting, the most interesting adventure in the whole world. There's nothing like the spiritual path. And what you find at the end of the day is what Ajahn Brahm calls the jewel at the heart of the lotus. As the lotus spreads out its petals under the sun, spreads out one petal after the other, this is a 1,000-petal lotus, right? It takes a long time for it to open up. You have to practice the spiritual path for a long time. And eventually, as it opens up, you come to the very core of the lotus. And what do you find there? You find nothing. You find emptiness. This is the Buddhist idea of non-self. And it's the most beautiful thing that you can possibly discover on the Buddhist path. And this is why it is so exciting and why it is so interesting. And this is where Buddhism really stands apart from all other teachings and what makes it really special. So, there you are, a little talk on some of the things that makes the Buddhist teachings unique. And now I expect many more converts to Buddhism after this. Because it's powerful, right? I mean, you've got to admit, it's pretty powerful stuff. So anyway, now we're going to open up the floor. So please, anyone, if you want to make any comment or you want to ask any questions, you want to say anything, you're very welcome to do so. So please fire away, as they say. Okay, there's one at the front over here. Yeah, maybe we can let Eddie go a little bit later because. So at the front here, very front.
Some time ago, I was taught about.
Thank you.
The universe. Buddha could see back. I can't remember if it was 28 kalpas ago. Is. Are you familiar with that word? Universes ago? Can you enlighten us a little in that area?
Yeah, it's very interesting, right? It's kalpa is the Sanskrit word. In Pali, we say kappa. It's the same word, a slightly different pronunciation. And according to the suttas, the Buddha could see back, there was a lot, 90 kalpas, or kappas, I think it was, according to the early Buddhist texts. And what are these kalpas? It's kind of fascinating. And the way they are described, they are described as kind of the evolving and devolving of the world. The world is the word loka, which means pretty much the way we use the word world. It can mean the universe, it can mean the planet Earth, depending on the context. But here it obviously means the universe. And talks about the evolution. The word is almost exactly the same as the word evolution, and then the opposite of evolution, which you might call devolution. I'm not sure what you would call that, or involution or something like that. And so when you look at those words, it is very tempting to think that this means exactly what we talk about when we talk about the expansion of the universe, evolution, and then maybe the contraction of the universe at a certain point. And I think the evidence from the suttas is strong enough to think that that actually is what it means, because these are very enormous time spans. And I think probably the Buddha was aware that the universe has this kind of cyclical thing about it, which is kind of amazing. And there is a book online called Buddhist Cosmology. Check it out. It has my name on it, by the way. Check it out. And it goes into much more detail about these kind of issues. So see what you make of that. Just a bit of PR for myself while I'm at it. Great. Anyone else like to say anything? Yeah. Please feel free to speak up. Everyone is content. Eddie, do you want to say? Eddie's turn. We always have to hear from Eddie. Yeah.
Thanks. John Bramley.
Yeah.
Thanks for the wonderful deep talk.
Yeah.
You are welcome. I remember, John Bramley.
Yeah.
I read in the scriptures, the Buddha said that not many people can understand his teaching. Only people who's got wisdom, can really understand his teaching, because his teaching goes very deep down, you see. Mm. It involves it's a do-it-yourself religion. You have to do it, walk the path,
DIY,
and coming back to what you said earlier about the circular Buddhists, they are only surface. Years ago, I was doing some little, research. They are only surface seers, this thing. They are not deep. Buddhism goes very deep.
Hmm.
What do you think?
I agree, absolutely. And I think when the Buddha says only a few people see his teaching, I think what he means there is probably seeing it fully, like, becoming enlightened and these kind of things, awakened. That's probably what he means by that. But I think a lot of people are able to see the more basic ideas, be kind and be happy, because kindness leads to happiness, both for oneself and for others. I think those more kind of surface things are easy to appreciate. And then as you develop those, then maybe down the track you can go all the way to non-self and all the way to those more profound things. But yes, I generally agree with you, Eddie. So
thank you.
You're well educated. All right. Anyone else? No, anyway, everyone really contented? Okay, that's good. Excellent. So then we have, as always, we have a few questions from outside. Oh, please. Yeah?
Hi, I'm sort of new to being in here, but all I want to say is thank you so much.
Okay, great.
It was an amazing talk, and thank you.
I'm glad to hear that. I didn't scare you for life? I always...
Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you for that wonderful feedback. That's wonderful to hear. Okay. All right, so a few questions from, actually all of these questions are from overseas, or at least most of them. First one is from Borneo, so hello in Borneo. Dear Ajahn, can you please kindly give words about how do we stop comparing life to others so that we can appreciate present no matter what, because being here is still an issue that I can't really understand. Comparing life to other. Do you mean comparing yourself to others? Is that what you mean? How do we stop comparing life to others? I'll assume that that's what you mean, comparing yourself to others. How can we stop comparing ourselves to others? The answer, very often the way we compare ourselves to others is so superficial. We compare ourselves to others in terms maybe of how much wealth we have, what kind of education we have, what we look like. All of these kind of very superficial things, and these are things that don't really matter in the world. Yeah, the one thing that matters is that whether we are making progress or not. If you are making progress on the spiritual path, you are going somewhere. Person may be very successful in worldly terms, they may be wealthy and have high status or whatever, but they may not be going anywhere. They may just kind of live off that wealth they have, and then they die and they wonder what happened. But if you are just an ordinary person, but you are actually going somewhere because you are developing yourself spiritually, then you are superior to that other person because you're making something out of your life. Yeah, and this is kind of the beautiful thing. So don't compare yourself to others in this kind of ordinary way in the world, because it doesn't matter. But if you are a good person, if you are on the spiritual path, if you're trying to become a better than what you were before, you are doing really, really well. And anyone in this world who is improving themselves by becoming more kind, more generous, more compassionate, more understanding, all of these things, they are the people really worthy of respect in the world, because they're going somewhere. They're really trying hard to live a better life. So think like that instead. Yeah, and don't think that you are superior, even though you are practicing. But again, don't think you are superior because of that. Because maybe today you are practicing and tomorrow you forget about not practicing anymore. Things change so rapidly. Maybe that other person who wasn't practicing before starts to practice. So we should never compare ourselves to others, because things are so changeable, things are so uncertain. All you need to focus on is whether you are living well. If you are living well, you're going to come to good results as a consequence. And then you can start to appreciate the present, because then you start to live the present to the best of your ability, because you know that that is where you develop, that's where you change, that is where you become a better person, by living well right now. Question from KL in Malaysia. Dear Ajahn, what are the main causes of suffering? How to stop suffering, especially when I have craving of pleasure of materialistic things? So what is the main cause of suffering? And of course the Buddha has a very profound answer to that. The main cause of suffering is birth. You were born, that is why you are suffering. If you hadn't been born, you would not be suffering. So that's where you went wrong. You shouldn't have been born in the first place. So that was a bad mistake to be born. But the Buddha takes it further than that. He says that craving is the main cause of suffering. Why is craving the main cause of suffering? Well, mainly because craving gives rise to new lives in the future, right? And that's why it kind of leads to more suffering in the future. But what you are talking about is more the craving immediately here and now. You're craving for materialistic things in the world and you want all of these kind of things. And the way to overcome that craving is to start practicing the spiritual path. First of all, to understand the hollowness of so many of those materialistic things. They are not as interesting as they seem. The Buddha has a lot of beautiful similes about the hollowness of the material things of the world. The simile of the dream, the simile of the borrowed goods, the simile of the fruit on the tree, the simile of the charcoal pit, the simile of the grass torch, the simile of the piece of meat, and the simile of the dog, I think, the butcher and the dog, and there's a couple of more which are listed there. But those are the main kind of similes. They're beautiful similes, and when you read them, you start to get to feel why the material world actually is not all that interesting at all. There is something else far more interesting, and that is the spiritual world, the development of your own mind. That is what is truly interesting. And as you gradually move away from that material world, because you start to see how unsatisfactory it is, and you start to develop your mind by living well, this starts to change. Your craving starts to die down. Or you are even shifting your craving a little bit. You crave maybe a little bit to be kind. You crave to do the right things. And it's a different kind of craving. But that is the kind of craving that leads ultimately to the end of craving. So just practice the Noble Eightfold Path. And as you do that, automatically your cravings will start to die down. Question from Singapore. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, how do I deal with guilt and self-blame and to forgive myself? Thank you. So the way to deal with guilt is really coming back to the profound teachings that I mentioned at the very end of my talk, the idea of non-self, the idea of anatta, as it is called, and to understand that you are the product of your conditioning. It's a very kind of basic Buddhist ideas. You are what you have become, and you have become this over in this life, depending on all your friends, your family, the school, the teachers, all of these kind of things, but also from past lives as well, right? And this is why past lives are so important. So it's really worthwhile investigating. Yeah? And all of these things have made you who you are. Your personality is built up by all this conditioning from the past. And because that is who you are trapped by that conditioning. That conditioning steers you. That conditioning makes you choose certain things. So if you are blaming yourself, that is really unfair. How can you blame yourself? You were conditioned to do those things, yeah? So if you blame yourself, you are like blaming a robot for following its program. It's like blaming the wind for blowing in the trees. How can you blame the wind for blowing in the trees? Instead of blaming yourself, have compassion for yourself. Remember that you are trapped by your past, that you are trapped by your habits, that you are trapped by your personality. You are trapped by all of this conditioning. You can't really do anything different from what you do at any particular time unless you have some Buddhist and spiritual input that reminds you, wait, stop, should I do something different? And because of that, always forgive yourself. Always understand that you too are a victim of your conditioning from the past. And when you understand that you are a victim, then you can forgive yourself. Everyone in this world is a victim in a certain way. Everyone in this world has been conditioned. Sometimes you see these terrible wars around the world, and maybe you blame the leaders behind these wars. But those leaders too are conditioned. They too don't really know what they're doing. They too ultimately are victims, even if they create enormous amounts of victims in the world around them, and for that reason should obviously be condemned for what they're doing, and they should, you know, whatever. Still, in a deep sense, they too are victims. And then we can have compassion even for the perpetrators of the worst crimes that happen around the world. Please look at yourself in that way. You can overcome self-blame and have more compassion for yourself. This is really the path forward. Non-self is a very useful teaching sometimes. Another question. Dear Ajahn, how do we keep the right view through the day and not get drawn into the day-to-day activities? How can we attend to day-to-day activities with right view? So what you have to do is you have to decide on what aspects of right view are important in day-to-day life, right? What are the issues that really matter in ordinary life? Right view is very broad. Right view has very many aspects to it. But there are certain aspects that are very practical and pragmatic and matter in everyday life. And one of the most important aspects of right view is that virtue, kindness, morality, goodness matters in the world. Yeah, it actually is very, very important how we live our life. That is the most important aspect of right view that you should bring with you into your daily life. It should be lodged in the back of your mind so powerfully that you almost never forget it as you go through your daily activities. Be kind. Don't give in to defilements. Don't give in to the stupidity sometimes that arises in the mind. That should be lodged in your mind. That is the right view that you need. And to be able to make that really strong, what you have to do is understand these Buddhist teachings. Understand why kindness is so important. The more you understand why kindness is important, the more powerfully it will be lodged in your mind, and you will never really be able to forget it. How do you do that? By studying, understanding these teachings, listening to good Dhamma talks, reading the word of the Buddha again and again and again, gradually brainwashing yourself with a beautiful Buddha brand brainwashing powder. Clean out the brain. Yeah, it's dirty in there. You're going to clean out all those kind of dodgy views and get bright, shining views in its place. So that is the way to do that. You cannot remember everything, so bring it down to a few simple things, then you're going to be on the right track. Question from London. Hello there in London. Dear Ajahn, how to clear bad karma from the past? Thank you. You don't say thank you too quickly, because I may not be able to answer the question, because the answer is you cannot actually fully clear bad karma from the past. The Buddha says there will always be a residue from bad karma. So what the Buddha says is that you can dilute the bad karma from the past. You can make it ripen in less kind of painful ways. And that is really what we should be trying to do. And how do you dilute the bad karma from the past? Well, what you do is that you do lots of good karma. You live well, and as you live well, as you purify yourself, as you brighten up your mind, as you become more wise and all these kind of things, the bad things that you have done get diluted and they start to disappear into the background and they're not so important anymore. And when that bad karma eventually ripens, you will hardly experience it at all. That is the right way to think about it. So the answer is always to live well. That is always the answer to almost everything in Buddhism. Live well to the max. Yeah, think of it as the very critical thing in your life. Everything matters. Every thought you have matters. Every action, every time you open your mouth, be very careful because words sometimes come out too fast. Yeah, and then you are on the right track. This is where the purification process happens, and this is where you lay the groundwork for meditation to happen later on. Okay, everyone, so that is all for tonight. So let's just pay respect to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha.
Patipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sangang namah.